Yeah, sure. In the mist. It's a great, great thing. That was always the peaks of a party we'd have, you know. Bix would sit down and play, and of course, absolute quiet and much respect for what he could do. He was much ahead of his time. The cornet was his instrument. The piano was just a marvelous form of relief for him. The greatest genius that I have ever known in the world of jazz is Bix Beiderbecke. And you could quote Gene Krupa.
Bix Beiderbecke is the biggest thrill I ever had in the music business. I was an impressionable guy. Not it was still the five of years to hear Bix today for the first time. I'd still have the same impression. Guys like Beiderbecke, they don't have those by dozens. Just one. In case there's any doubt, my name is Conant, Eddie Conant, and I want to state right now, and I've stated many, many times, Beiderbecke's the biggest thrill I've ever had in the music business. He played the piano like no one else played the piano. He played the cornet like no one else played the cornet. Now, what more can I say? What a modest guy. And what a talented guy.
Hello out there, this is Dave Bartholomew, and I want to introduce you to a series on the life of one of America's greatest jazz stars, Bix Beiderbecke. But first, let's take a trip back to 1971.
Davenport, Iowa, and a salute to the memory of Bix Beiderbecke, one of America's most brilliant jazz musicians. The young Bix died in August of 1931. And Davenport decided it was time to honor him in a big way. Support in this project was not restricted to local musicians and jazz buffs, for it was Bill Donahoe, an East Coast advertising executive, who organized the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Band, which flew to Davenport from New Jersey for the occasion. They arrived in Davenport on Thursday evening, August 5th, boarded a bus for the motel, and the music began.
Is the police escort?
Yeah.
Come on, dude. Run it wild. Here we go. 1, 2.
Friday, August 6th, 1971, marked the 40th anniversary of Bix's death at 28 years of age. The memorial committee and guests began the day by toasting the immortal Bix at a champagne breakfast. Then it was off to the Oakdale Cemetery, where 1,500 persons gathered at the Beiderbecke family plot in tribute to the great jazz cornetist. A wreath was placed on Bix's grave by Bob Cook, president of Local 67, American Federation of Musicians. And the Reverend C.H. Meyer eulogized Bix. In the background, the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Band played Bix's own composition, Davenport Blues.
Bix Beiderbecke's life was cut short when he passed from this life at the early age of 28. Knowing the joy and happiness he had brought to many people, we should not be surprised at the brevity of his life. We know at best that life is brief on this earth. We are all given this life for a work to do. And when that is accomplished, the Almighty above gives us our reward. It's not the duration of life that counts, rather it's the donation. What we give to life. Not how many years here, but what we put into these years. Bix accomplished his purpose, his work on earth at an early age, and was called his eternal reward, August 6, 1931, having heard those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of the Lord." Today, just 40 years later, we gather here to pay tribute not only to Vic Spiderbeck, the musician, but also to Vic Spiderbeck, the man. Here, with reverence and great admiration, we pause to honor and pay tribute to him who became legendary before death and whose legend swells and broadens since death, much as do the ever-widening ripples from a stone dropped in the center of a placid pool. Today we thank God for the life of Vic Spiderbeck. Now his good works live on. His memory and his music belong to the ages.
Following graveside services, the entourage advanced to the Davenport Public Library. Representatives from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, presented the library with a copy of a definitive biographical radio series on the life and music of Vic Spiderbeck. The series, entitled Vic, consists of 19 one-half-hour radio programs and was produced by Miami University Radio through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Spiderbeck devotees then visited Davenport's Danceland Ballroom, where Vic performed during the winters of 1929 and 1930. In the early afternoon, the group boarded the riverboat Rambler to play on the mighty Mississippi, so closely associated with Vic and the migration of jazz from the South. A dream turned into reality for the Vic Spiderbeck Memorial Jazz Band.
Billy, stick them up, Captain. We're going to New Orleans.
All right, go ahead.
One.
Everything went as planned. The tribute to Vic was an overwhelming success. One of the people responsible for handling the arrangements for the affair was Esten Spurrier. Mr. Spurrier, a cornetist himself and longtime friend of the late Vic, talks about the events of the day.
We didn't know exactly what the reaction would be. And Donnie Odette, one of the best emulations of Vic on cornet, whose father knew Vic well and was a great admirer. And he's the second generation of this. So Donnie had never had any experience with such a promotion, so forth. I pressed him into service as the next generation who will keep the Vic saga alive. So here's Don.
Those of us that believe it and to be involved in this thing, to try to do it and to have it happen here, the new bunch of people that try to carry it on for what it is and for the man, for what he was, that we're just very proud to do all of this.
The fuss over a jazz musician from Davenport, Iowa, who died 40 years ago? The answer is simple. He was a born musical genius. Vic was idolized by his contemporaries and understood by only a few. Vic was the ideal subject for the mythmakers, a ready-made hero when the jazz men of the 30s needed one. Spiderbeck's brief professional career spanned prohibition and speakeasies, high living, bathtub gin, and the birth of the big band. Vic was part of it all. He grew with jazz from the Mississippi riverboats docked at his hometown to the roaring clubs in Chicago to the swank ballrooms of New York. For almost a decade, he played the piano and became author of several compositions, and he blew a horn like it had never been heard before or since. Thank you. August 1931, this young man passed from the jazz scene. At the time of his death, Leon Bix Beiderbecke was alone and destitute. Bix, a high school dropout, a self-taught musician, had been part of two of the most successful bands of the 20s. Bix played unique music, always distinctively his. In the weariest days of his disillusion, Bix pursued his quest for the expression of new musical ideas. He left the world only a few recordings and five piano compositions. But he also left the legend created around him, and he was a landmark in the most American of art forms, jazz. This is Bill Utter speaking for Miami University Radio in Oxford, Ohio.
Now here it is, 2001, the 70th anniversary of Bix's death. We at WMKV are proud to bring you this historical series of 19 programs. And here to discuss the original production are Bill Utter, executive producer and narrator, and Frank Powers, who commented on the many recordings. Bill, tell us how the series came to be.
Thank you, Bart. It's a real pleasure to be here with you and with Frank. And as we'll be talking a little later, Frank was a very important part of this series. Perhaps you'd be interested in knowing how this series came about. I was manager of WMUB, the station, the public radio station at Miami University. And in about 1968... I was sitting on my back porch listening to a public radio station doing a jazz show, and I thought, you know, we could do better than that. And then I remembered visits with my brother-in-law, Joe Campbell, who eventually became a consultant on this series, who introduced me to the music of Bix Beiderbecke. He had been a collector for years, and in his youth he had bought, he would go and buy a Bix record and then another Bix record, one that he would play and one that he would set aside. So he had virtually a complete collection of Bix Beiderbecke music, and all of it in mint condition. At any rate, coincidentally, in 1969, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which had been recently founded, and NPR, which was very early in its stages, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting announced a request for grant proposals, and it was, I think, called Sounds of Radio, and got to thinking that maybe a good proposal would be a series on this man, Bix Beiderbecke, because, frankly, I didn't know much about him, and the stories my brother-in-law had told me were very interesting. So we wrote a proposal. We made contact with Phil Evans, out in California, who was at that time writing a biography of Bix. And we made contact with my brother-in-law, and we made contact with a man named Joe Steiner, a great record collector in Chicago. Steve Hathaway, the director of broadcasting, and I put together this proposal. And in June of 1969, we were awarded a grant, along with about 10 other stations, to produce a radio show. We were given $4,632 to produce 13 radio programs. So we thought, boy, we're going to be able to do something very interesting. At that time at WMUB was a man named Jim Grover. He was our director of special broadcast services and more or less our music director, too. And Jim was a graduate of Eastman School of Music and was a trumpet man. And a brass instrumentation major. He was taking a degree with us and was also on our staff at WMUB. And we thought this would be perfect for Jim to do this project, to produce this project. And he became very interested in it. And the more he learned about Bix Beiderbecke, the more glad he was that he was doing it. He was able to travel around the country with the limited funds we had, occasionally take Mike McGuire, an engineer, a student engineer, along with him, and interview people who knew Bix, people in Bix's family, and Mr. Steiner in Chicago contributed some audio, and some research was provided by the other people that I've mentioned. As the program progressed, it became obvious to us that we couldn't tell the story in 13 programs that we had been granted for, but the series eventually came to 19 programs in the series. And within the series, we were very fortunate that Frank Powers, a wonderful musician here in Cincinnati, was available and helped comment on some of the music that Bix played and added his expertise to the series. All in all, it was really a very rewarding experience. I would like to comment that Jim Grover just did a superb job, and as a matter of fact, this series became his creative thesis for his master's program at Miami University. Right after this series was first broadcast on NPR in 1972. We completed it and copyrighted it the previous year in 1971. Jim left us to go to work in Columbus for the State Board of Education as their media specialist, media director, I guess, and also was married to Nancy Widows Grover. And they were married for 7 years before Jim began to develop the symptoms of MS, which unfortunately he has had for a number of years now, over 20 years. But Jim remains has a very fine mind and is so pleased that this series is going to be rebroadcast, Bart and Frank. And I'm just hoping that he will be able to hear it, and I'm sure he will. I think that one of the interesting things about the series is that when Jim went out to make interviews, to do interviews, he was not always talking with people who were accustomed to being recorded. And an example of that would be a woman named Ruth Schaffner, who lived in St. Louis, whom Bix had known in the mid-20s. And we found out that she lived with her two sisters in St. Louis, and many, many years after the fact was willing to talk with us about, to talk with Jim Grover about her knowledge of Bix and some of his pals and the dances they went to and so on in the old days. But she wasn't particularly used to talking into a recording, as you'll see in this little snippet from an early part of the interview.
Mrs. Sweeney, when did you first meet Bix Beiderbecke? Was Bix at the Arcadia Ballroom?
Yes, sir. He was.
You don't have to serve me.
Oh, okay.
What did you call Bix when you first... How was he introduced to you? Do you remember? What name did they use? Did they use Leon or Bix?
Bix.
And you called him Bix?
I was trying to do it.
Shh. I don't want a word coming from anybody else. How was it that you happened? How was it that you happened to meet Bix? Did you? Did the girls, the three of you, go down and to the ballroom every once in a while and listen to the bands that came through?
Yes.
Before you met Bix, did you have an interest in jazz music?
Oh, not especially.
Had you ever heard of Bix Beiderbecke before you met him?
No, I hadn't.
And it was just a big surprise, a very pleasant surprise.
Very.
And your initial reaction that this was a very fine young gentleman.
Yes.
He was dressed neatly.
Very.
And so that was the first go-round with Ruth, who had known Bix back in the mid-20s, 1925, 26. Eventually, Ruth and her two sisters all talked about Bix and Bing Crosby and Pee-wee Russell, who were there during that period. And Jim finally got her to become more accustomed to the microphone. And in Program 7 of this series, There's a very touching interview with her in which she talks about how what a fine person Bix Beiderbecke was, and how, to quote her, I think, it's fond memories to talk about him. We were good friends. Might have been more had he lived, unquote. And that was a very typical example of the kind of interviewing Jim had to do for this series.
Bill, you got to be narrator of the series by default. Would you tell us about that?
that's really quite correct, Bart. I should say that this series grew, as I said, to 19 half hours, and Jim Grover was under a lot of pressure to get the series completed and into CPB before a date certain, which happened to be the end of the calendar year 1970. And it came down to the fact that we had to do the narration in two evening sessions for 19 shows. And somehow we got it done, and then Jim got, that was in mid-December, Jim got engaged in mid-December, and somehow he managed to edit all these shows after the narration was cut in mid to late December and got it all shipped off. During that time of narration, I heard a lot of the voice of Frank Powers, this wonderful reed man in Cincinnati, and Frank was a very valuable asset to the series in his commenting on the music of Bix Beiderbecke. Good to be with you, Frank. Even
well,
though
thanks,
we didn't
Bill.
Meet until some years after the series down at DeFelice's.
Yes, I was a musician down there with the band, and you came up to me as I was getting a Coca-Cola out of the hose, you know, that they have. Anyway, I think I should mention one thing. I was sort of a commentator by default because originally they had contacted Carl Halen, a marvelous cornetist who has similarities in his style to Bix Beiderbecke and Bobby Hackett also, a great friend of mine for many years. And Carl even shared the German-American heritage of Bix Beiderbecke, and he had made a recording with Marty Gross called Hooray for Bix, which was very well received and which commemorated Bix Beiderbecke's music. So, but Carl is reticent about doing things like that, I guess, so he recommended me to Jim Grover, I guess it must have been that called him, and then I heard from Jim, and he'd come down with a big Ampex tape recorder and set it on the floor and hand me a microphone, and he said, "Now I want you to talk about this," and we'd sip a little scotch, and he'd say, "Well, you'd better repeat that over again because you slurred some of your words."
And
so we would do that, and then Bart tells me he can hear the Zoo Eden 49 bus turning around on some of these commentaries because I lived at the turnaround of that particular bus line in Mount Adams about 1970 when we were doing all this. But Jim Grover, he would be so delighted. You'd say something and he'd just explode with mirth and say, and you could say, it's a real gotcha line, you know, because he was very animated and interested in what he was doing. He was quite a guy, and it was a joy to do this.
Frank, that's very good to hear, and I agree with you. Jim Grover is just a wonderful man, and his enthusiasm for this project grew and grew, and he's so happy that this is being redone.
We're glad for him.
Well, just think about it for a minute. You and Frank, Bill, you and Frank and Jim Grover are the only three voices of people who are still alive today in this series. But all these jazz greats that were interviewed in the series are gone now. So this is a real piece of history.
Also, the three consultants, Joe Campbell and John Steiner and Phil Evans, are also have also passed. There's one person still around, a fellow named Mike McGuire, who was audio engineer on a lot of the pieces when he was a student. And I talked with him recently about visiting Gene Krupa's basement and finding out that his practice set was nothing but plywood circles. And he said, "This is not cool enough for Krupa." You know, But looking back about this series has been a lot of fun, and it's wonderful that WMKV-FM is going to not only put it on the air, but also stream it on the Internet. I think it's just marvelous.
It never fails that somebody will approach me and ask about the series. You know, I've heard from it from people all over the world who have heard this thing because bootleg tapes of the series have been floating throughout the globe for many years.
Yes, they have. Mm-hmm. I've heard from people as far away as South America and England who have heard other people's bootleg copies and wondering how to get them and that kind of thing. So it's out there, going to be out there.
Well, it's hard to say how many generations some of these tapes are removed from the original recordings, which appear to have become mislaid over the years.
I think we should say, though, that Bart, you've just done a marvelous labor of love here in taking the tapes that were available and inserting fresh music over the music that was recorded on these tapes several generations down by the time you heard them.
Music technology has changed a lot. The CD has come in, and all of these records sound a lot better now than they did 30 years ago.
And you've done so much to preserve this series and present it in a fresh form, and it's just going to be a marvelous 10 weeks, isn't it? This program constitutes the pre-number one show,
right?
And then there'll be two shows back-to-back.
Each airing, there'll be two half-hour shows. Yes. Uh-huh.
That's terrific.
So, as you say, it was a labor of love because I've been a Bix fan since I was about 14 or 15 years old. When I was in high school, a friend of mine who played trombone came in and said, "Boy, my brother just got an album of a cornet player. He says he'll really knock you flat." And I played this Columbia album of Bix Jazz as It Should Be Played, and I've been hooked ever since.
Well, if you stay tuned for the first program in this series of 19 programs about Bix Beiderbecke, you'll hear Louis Armstrong's voice very soon. That was one of Jim Grover's regrets, that Louis Armstrong was too sick to do a live interview, but the interview is by phone, and I think you'll find it quite interesting. Also, you'll hear a number of Bix's friends, Frank Trombauer, Jimmy McPartland, Paul Whiteman, Bing Crosby, all in the series.
Thank you, Bill Utter, and thank you, Frank Powers. And now, everybody, stay tuned for episode 1 of Bix.